Mr. Lab?
It is. Good morning, Chief Justice.
Good morning to you, but let's give everybody a second to get in and out of the courtroom. And you may proceed.
Morning, Your Honors. Morning, Counsel. May it please the court. My name is Nathan Lab. I represent the appellant, Michael Lane, in this case. While I raise a number of arguments in my appeal, I'm going to focus on the argument that I believe is we're here today, and that is the issue of can we allow a plea that was in part based upon erroneous information of the state and district court stand as a plea that was entered knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily. Short version of my answer is we can. Before I expand upon that, there is one area of my brief that I do want to talk about. I know I spend some deal of time regarding the motion to suppress. I found it just very peculiar. Nothing else, but this case was essentially both started and ended in a very similar and concerning circumstance. And what I mean by that is this case began when law enforcement approached the appellant, basically told him, we believe you've done something wrong. If you confess to that, it's not a crime, so let's end this now. Upon that recitation, he responds and says, okay, I confess. And law enforcement officer then says, you know what, I was wrong, that is a crime, and arrests him. Fast forward 6 months later, and in a plea colloquy, the appellant is advised both by the state and the district court that upon his conviction, he will not have to register as a sex offender. So again, he enters a plea based on information that was, and again, I don't want to insinuate or suggest in any way, shape, or form that the district court was in any way trying to insinuate or this was anything other than a simple mistake, but the mistake of the court led him to enter a plea which then subjected him to the sex offender registry and was something he was explicitly told he would not have to do as part of his conviction.
Let me back up here with your choice of words. The court led him to enter a plea.
Poor choice of words on
well,
my part.
Well, what can we know from the record at this point in time?
We know
is this fair to say the hearing was a plea hearing?
It was a plea hearing. And during that time, during the normal colloquy where he is advised you have certain rights, the state and the district court both indicate to him that he will not have to register. Explicitly advised him he does not have to register.
So he already agreed to the plea before he got to the hearing.
My understanding from the record is the plea agreement was essentially for a reduction of the charges and nothing further. So I think the only thing we can infer from that is he was getting a reduction. I think anything beyond that is probably...
And he accepted that offer and went to court to finalize it.
Correct. And upon the plea colloquy, the district court then states, I will find that you've made a knowing, intelligent, voluntary waiver.
The district court had made no advisement whatsoever about that consequence of registration, there would have been no problem?
Likely not. According to Schneider and the jurisprudence of this court, probably not. I think this case is distinguishable enough, that we don't really have to refine or disavow Schneider. From a personal standpoint, I would, in all candor, prefer it. I believe that the placement on the sex offender registry is something that someone should be advised of. I understand Schneider says that's not the case, but here it's distinguishable enough because in Schneider, the defendant in that case was never advised at all whether or not he would have to register. It's only after the plea and before sentencing he says, wait a minute, now that I know this, I may have made a different decision.
The statutory scheme contemplates signing a form at sentencing?
Yes.
It doesn't contemplate any advisement at all at taking a plea?
Yes, statutorily it's not there to suggest it. I think it's very similar to like the immigration context, where it was a slow build to the point where there was then a statute enacted, I believe, in 2002, 29-.
Can you give any authority for any other precedent regarding a collateral consequence other than immigration that's ever been used to set aside a plea?
I can't. I don't believe there's necessarily... out there. I hope I'm wrong, but I don't believe there's any jurisprudence I can find that specifically says it's a collateral issue. There's a problem, but I haven't seen anything on point.
Let me interrupt only to say, but the jurisprudence on the immigration consequences probably flows from Padilla.
That's true.
So So back to Justice Castle's question, what's your best authority in this
circumstance? My argument goes back to basically the framework in State v. Molina and Applet that basically says that there's a showing of manifest injustice, then even post-sentencing, a defendant has the right to a cause plea. And I think here, the big difference between that case and this one is the manifest injustice is clear from the record in the fact that a defendant was provided incorrect information. And I think if from a judicial perspective, I allude to this, and I think in State v. Moore, that a judge's primary responsibility is to uphold the equity of the courtroom, and if the district court, when an adversarial system is tasked with being the impartial and unbiased voice, at the very least need to be held accountable for providing correct information.
Wasn't an attorney, not misconduct, but a failure to perform the duties of an attorney? Wasn't it a failure of counsel case?
Yeah, it was basically the case of saying defense counsel hasn't been able to make sure the defendant is
so even Padilla doesn't require a court to advise of the circumstance.
I believe it does, and I may be wrong there. I was quoting. I thought Padilla was more of an expansion saying it's not just the court. We're expanding and saying defense counsel as well has to make sure that advice in the case is made to the
so that's the only precedent that you're relying on.
Well, in Nebraska, we've got a statute that says you can withdraw your plea if you don't get a particular kind of immigration advisement, correct?
Correct.
And we don't have anything like that with respect to the sex offender registration, do we?
We do not. I would say that I'd be in a much different situation. However, I believe those statutes are created once we kind of show this ship on the climate that necessitates. I think this is the beginning of that ship. I don't necessarily think that although a statute is necessary at this point, I think we're in that regret. So I think we can almost get out of the realm of whether it's collateral, whether it's specific to the sex offender registry. I think if a court's going to go outside of the boundaries of non-collateral issues, a plea hearing, and advise a defendant of certain rights, they should at least be held accountable to say they have to be accurate with that information.
So if the court had said, well, I don't think you're required to register, but I really don't know for sure. Where does that fall on which side of the line does that fall on?
That's a great question. It's a quagmire I hope no court would walk themselves into. I believe at that point it would at least open up the dialogue, and I can say I've been in a very similar situation where I thought certainly there was going to be a case that didn't require the registration. I was asked by the court. And even though I was certain at the time, by the end of that hearing, all of us, the court, myself, and the prosecutor included, all had our statute books out to make sure we were correct.
So the wise trial judge would tell the defendant in that situation, go talk to your lawyer about this. Don't ask me.
Potentially, I would think that if a district court were going to take that step and bring that up in a hearing, they would do it with enough foresight to know, here's what is the proper advising. Rather than open up a can of worms and say, now that I've opened it, I don't know where to go.
Well, that somewhat leads into your claims of ineffective counsel.
Correct, and that's an issue where...
And whether or not counsel was deficient in not saying something at the time with respect to the requirements of SORA.
Yes, and I can't try and lean into the counsel's mindset to know if they were aware of it or what the situation was. I wish it would have been corrected because I believe at that point it would have been addressed very quickly, but we're left in a situation where with counsel's silence, we're left with the statement of the district court in the state, which was clearly against 29-4003 saying they have to register.
With respect to the same issue packaged in the ineffective counsel portion of your appeal, the state says the record's insufficient at this time on direct appeal.
I would argue that the omission of the counsel to say anything in that time is probably sufficient enough to say it should have been. In other words, I think the record's sufficient because they should have known. Something should have been said, but there was a complete omission upon a clear error of the state.
Would it be true if counsel knew that the counsel and the defendant had talked about it and that the counsel had, in fact, said you will be subject to lifetime registration?
That's possible. I would insinuate, I think it's the opposite inference because nothing was brought up, that if they did have a conversation, it was probably the conversation that you will not be subject to the registration.
But we don't know because the record doesn't tell us.
Correct. That's an inference I can't make. I do have a few short moments here, if I could, saving time for rebuttal and other questions.
Thank you very much. Ms. Duffy, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Counsel, I'm Siobhan Duffy, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the appellee, the State of Nebraska. Appellant's assigned errors relate to the validity of his plea, the effectiveness of the counsel he received, and the sentence imposed. The State believes the District Court properly addressed all matters, and we ask you to affirm the judgment of the District Court. Regarding Appellant's plea, he did not move to withdraw his plea in the District Court, and he is arguing to this Court that his plea was invalid because he was mistakenly advised his conviction would not subject him to SORA registration. However, as was noted previously, this Court has held that the registration provisions of SORA are collateral to a conviction, and that a plea is not rendered invalid because a defendant is unaware of the registration requirements. The State does not believe that the Appellant's plea in this case is rendered invalid because he was mistakenly advised about this collateral consequence. Turning to Appellant's ineffective assistance of counsel claims, while preparing for this argument, I came across a 2015 opinion by this Court that was not cited in my brief that I do believe applies here, and it is State v. Merheb, 290 NEB 83, again from 2015.
What was the page? The page again, please.
83. And it relates specifically to counsel's advice on collateral matters. And in that case, the defendant had been convicted of an earlier crime during the pendency of his post-conviction case, was released, and it was his argument was due to the incorrect immigration advice or to non-immigration advice he had received. And it was after the Supreme Court's opinion in Padilla. And so he was arguing that he should be allowed to withdraw his plea because he had not been informed of the immigration consequences. And this Court noted, in that opinion, this Court stated, as a general proposition, counsel's advice about collateral matters, those not involving the direct consequences of a criminal conviction, is irrelevant under the Sixth Amendment. Such an analysis is excluded from a Strickland v. Washington analysis on the ineffective assistance of counsel. And this Court then went on to discuss how the United States Supreme Court had specifically carved out a distinction in the case of immigration matters in Padilla, and then in, I believe, Chavez, where the Court noted that it was a new rule it was creating. So the State does think that that may be controlling on appellant's claims related to the advice he received regarding collateral matters.
But the matter that's been carved out is limited to the immigration.
Correct.
Universe of immigration issues.
Correct, Your Honor. That is the State's reading of Padilla and Chavez. I know that in Padilla, the Court...
And we have a statute.
Yes, Your Honor. In Nebraska, there is a statute with a specific word-for-word advisement that should be given. If this Court does disagree and still finds that these matters should be brought under an ineffective or do fall within that Strickland analysis, the State does not believe the record on appeal is sufficient to address them because we don't know whether discussions did take place between counsel and appellant regarding his or her registration either before or after. The State believes the same applies to appellant's assignment of error related to the failure of counsel to withdraw his plea. We don't know, again, any conversations that took place, any research counsel did, or any strategic decisions that went into those decisions. And we just don't believe we have enough information to really make a determination at this time. Regarding appellant's assignment of error related to the motion to suppress, we believe this to be without merit. Appellant was fully informed by the District Court that by pleading, he was waiving the right to challenge the ruling on his motion to suppress. Appellant stated he understood, and he chose to plead to the charge regardless.
Standing alone, and assuming your recitation of propositions of law are correct, where I get confused is that if there were no plea, then what? Was this a meritorious motion to suppress, or do we know, or is the record insufficient?
Your Honor, the District Court did rule on the motion to suppress and found, and it denied the motion to suppress. I think that appellant in brief really focuses on what he believes to be the strength of his motion to suppress argument, but I don't think that that's the end inquiry, whether it was meritorious or not, because I think that there are strategic reasons. Perhaps even if the motion had been granted, there could have been other evidence. Other reasons, the reduction in the charges.
So counsel could say you have a fine chance on your denial of motion to suppress on appeal, but you have a deal and it's in your interest, that would be my professional recommendation.
I think we don't know that. Correct, Your Honor.
It's conceivable.
It is conceivable. I think so, Your Honor. I think that, you know, we don't know what went on, and we don't know what went into these discussions and the decisions to enter the plea.
Which, could you clarify for me here? This became a, on the amended information, it became a Class 3, is that correct?
Correct. It was originally a Class 2A felony, which I believe the penalty would have been up to 20 years imprisonment, and then was amended to a Class 3 felony, subjecting the appellant to a maximum of 4 years imprisonment.
Okay, and the underlying facts for the plea were uncle, niece?
Correct, Your Honor.
And the age, and the age of the...
I believe that the age of the victim was 16, but I'm not positive on that. She may have been. I'm not positive.
And what's the relevance of her age?
There's a harsher, the class 2 felony, so she must have been under 17. Incest with a victim 17 or under, she may have been 17. She was at least 17 or 16. Because incest victim 17 or under is a class 2A felony, whereas incest with a victim 18 or over is a class 3 felony. So he was originally charged with victim 17 or under and pled to victim 18.
So with the amended information, does that refer to the victim as 18 or... There's some parenthetical that I'm not sure I know.
The amended information says incest, parenthetical victim 18, and then in the your body it says...
That just tracks the statute.
Yeah, correct, Your Honor.
So help me out again then. To what extent is age relevant?
The charge of incest when a victim is 17 or under is a class 2 felony. Mm-hmm. And incest when a victim is 18 is a class 3 felony. An appellant was originally charged with incest victim 17 or under, a class 2 felony, and ultimately pled to incest victim 18.
How old was she?
Your Honor, I don't recall. I believe that because it was originally charged as victim 17 or under, she may have been 17. It may have been 16.
Is this a fiction for plea purposes? The age of the victim?
Your Honor, I'm not sure. And I don't recall the exact age of the victim, so I don't recall, and I apologize.
Okay. If it is a fiction, what's the effect of that?
Your Honor, I'm not sure. I haven't actually considered that issue. I think, I'm not sure, Your Honor. If there are no other questions...
Was there a sentencing matter you wanted to talk about?
Well, Your Honor, the sentence here, the district court imposed a sentence of 4 to 4 years imprisonment along with a term of 2 years post-release supervision.
That's an indeterminate sentence.
Well, Your Honor, the state believes that some previous statements by this court in other cases have indicated that a sentence that is for... either a single term of years or a definite term of years. So in this case, 4 to 4 years imprisonment previously could have been considered a determinate sentence because it was for a finite term of years.
Isn't that exactly the opposite of what we said in State versus Artis?
Well, Your Honor, I think that in Artis, this court was focusing on indeterminate sentences. And I suppose that the state's argument here is that a sentence of 4 to 4 years imprisonment could be both determinate if a period of post-release supervision is imposed, or indeterminate because it involves...
So the state's argument is that you look at whether or not there's post-release supervision to determine whether a sentence is indeterminate or determinate?
I think that's part of it, Your Honor.
That's what the trial court said. That was the tail wagging the dog. Well, there's the post-release stuff. It must be determinate.
Correct, Your Honor. And I think that even if this court disagrees with the state's proposition, I think that here the sentencing court originally said 4 to 4, was informed by defense counsel that it needed to be one term of years, and the sentencing court then said, well, I mean it to be 4 years. I'm imposing post-release supervision. I'm just saying, I believe you said I'm saying 4 to 4 so that they know that I mean 4 years. So even if this court disagrees and finds that it is an indeterminate sentence, I think that this court could simply modify the order to reflect that 4 years.
Elsewhere in your brief, you're suggesting that to your knowledge, nowhere in the record is there a record of SORA advisements, and that one solution to that is to...
I think
the state's solution would be the plea stands but vacate sentencing?
I think that, I don't know that that would be part of the sentencing, Your Honor. And I will be honest, I was sort of at a loss as to what would be a good remedy for that. You know, in looking at the statute that requires notification by the sentencing court, it also requires notification from the Department of Corrections to an individual convicted of one of those offenses upon release. It requires the Department of Motor Vehicles to put notifications in their applications for driver's licenses, I believe for regular operators' vehicles and commercial. So I think that if the purpose of the statute is to make sure that a defendant is aware of his duties, I think that there are other ways that he, and clearly he's aware now, that he has to register. So that was just a suggestion that kind of came to the state's mind, but I think that there are probably alternatives that this court may feel are better suited.
Thank you.
I am completely out of time, so if there are no other questions, we would ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? 27 seconds. Mr. Lab.
Thank you again. I think to allude to what perhaps Justice Moore Lerman was indicating, all this other stuff kind of becomes moot if we determine that he was not entered knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily, and so that's the drama I'm going to continue to beat with what time I've got left. I'd love to be arguing the suppression motion. I believe that's the strongest argument I would have, but because we entered a plea, or Mr. Lane entered a plea, I'm precluded from doing so, and I think that just highlights how important that right is to a defendant, the most important one they possess, to either proceed to trial or enter a plea, because they waive all rights. So anything that infringes upon that or may influence that right is something that I certainly think needs to be heavily scrutinized. For those reasons, I'd ask the court to really focus on the misadvisement of the district court and state and determine whether or not that plea can stand as knowingly, intelligent, and voluntary.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you very much. The next case